Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, Carolina Wilson's a reporter with Bloomberg News. She's on the show a lot. She did some great ETF reporting, and she came with an idea for a podcast episode recently, which was QQQ, which just turned 20. And we were like, that's a really good idea.
Yeah, it made us think of one of these in-the-field type episodes that Rachel Evans has done a couple times where you take the mic out and you just see what happens. And I thought, you know, the Qs is a monster ETF. Most people focus on SPY, which I believe turned 25 recently. That was a whole deal. But the Qs is right up there. I mean, I'd put it on the Mount Rushmore of ETFs.
And what is it?
The Qs is the NASDAQ 100. So this is remember the 90s and the tech? This is when the NASDAQ was a big deal. All these stocks were on there. But the Qs has changed since then. Although, again, it's still, I think, widely used for tech play, growth play. And it trades a ton, like multiple billions of dollars every day. It's a total stud, but it's probably got some things about it that most people just don't know about or take for granted.
One being that it used to be very big on tech and it's become less so over time. So we gave Carolina a microphone and sent her out to the field, and here's what we found out. This week on Trillions, the Qs at 20.
This is probably the most awkward thing I'm going to have you do all day. So I'm just asking them to say the alphabet and stop when they get to Q.
Oh my God, that's so...
Oh my goodness gracious.
I have to sing?
A, B, C, D,
E, F, G, H, I,
J, K,
L, M, N, O, P,
Q.
Over the course of history, the letter Q has taken on many different meanings. Perhaps the most obvious, Q is the 17th letter of the modern English alphabet. Some say the form of the letter could have been based on the eye of a needle, a knot, or even a monkey with its tail hanging down. Others have suggested that the origin is even more ancient, maybe having been born from Egyptian hieroglyphics. But for the trillion-dollar exchange-traded fund industry, the letter Q takes on its own unique meaning. You see, the Invesco QQQ Trust Series 1 ETF, known by its ticker QQQ, is without a doubt one of the most recognizable tickers around, and a byword for technology investing. Weighing in at just over $72 billion, QQQ is the world's sixth largest ETF in terms of assets. It's also the second most traded ticker among the universe of more than 2,200 ETFs. And not too long ago, it celebrated its 20th birthday. So I dived deeper into QQQ's history and learned how an ETF that was a poster child for the dot-com boom is no longer really a tech ETF, and how this mammoth of a fund is a window into how presumably passive vehicles are actually living, breathing organisms that are actively changing and evolving with markets. To talk about the origin of QQQ, commonly known as the Qs, I'll have to take you back to the man who created its underlying index, the NASDAQ 100. Meet John Jacobs. He was running strategic planning at NASDAQ in 1999, and one of the things he realized was that the brand perception among retail investors was very low about the NASDAQ.
So we set about trying to figure out how to change their perception, raise the awareness of NASDAQ and change their perception. One of the ideas we came up with in the strategic planning team that I was running at NASDAQ was, let's come up with a NASDAQ-branded financial product. And when we looked around, there was something that had been launched a few years earlier, the SPDR, which was the first ETF on the S&P 500. So we started following in their footsteps to create this one. So the original exercise that became QQQ was more of a branding exercise, much more than trying to build an index business.
But along with branding power came a unique nuance with QQQ's revenue model. The first ETFs that came out, like the Qs, were unit investment trusts. For the expense ratio, there's a chunk that went to the trustee, some went to the admin, and some money went to marketing. But there's essentially no way to make money if you are the product sponsor. This made it difficult to sell QQQ over to PowerShares Capital Management, which was bought by Invesco in late 2006, the current home of QQQ. To learn about that hesitancy, I spoke to Bruce Bond, who helped start PowerShares back in 2002.
You know, the QQQ, it was very difficult to talk Invesco into actually acquiring the QQQ at the time. And the reason it was or allowing me to buy at PowerShares was that, you know, the QQQ was not doesn't generate any revenue for the firm that owns it. What it does have, though, is it had a 10 basis point marketing fee that allow you to market the fund. And so what we did was when we acquired it, we struck a new agreement with NASDAQ for the licensing of the index from NASDAQ. We acquired the fund and used the remaining marketing fee to market. Well, we changed the name of the fund from the NASDAQ 100 QQQ to the PowerShares QQQ, and which gave PowerShares a tremendous amount of visibility and marketing and advertising power and a built-in resource to be able to elevate the name of PowerShares in the industry.
To see where some of those marketing dollars were going, I headed over to the Chicago area and Invesco's headquarters in Downers Grove, Illinois. That's how I ended up at the Lincoln Park Zoo.
His name is Sahar.
Sounds like a lion name.
Yes, that's right. Her name is Malika, and her name is Sala something or other. I can't blank it out.
And the Qs do seem to be infused in the Chicago culture. The fund sponsors the zoo's annual light show spectacular, the current headlining performance at the Lyric Opera of Chicago, golf tournaments, tennis tournaments. They've even sponsored the first race of the NASCAR Xfinity Series season, a 300-mile-long annual race held at the Daytona International Speedway called the PowerShares QQQ 300. The letter Q even makes a special appearance in the name of Invesco's current QQQ strategist. Listen to this.
So I am John Frank. I joined Invesco in April of 2016, and I am the QQQ strategist.
So you missed your middle initial there, though.
I did. It's actually,
why don't you tell us about that?
It's actually John Q. Frank, which when I was interviewing for the role to become the QQQ strategist, I think my manager really enjoyed that.
I think maybe that got you the job, honestly.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree.
While QQQ was a poster child for technology investing when it launched, the fund's holdings have evolved significantly over time. How much tech there actually is in QQQ is one question that John has to tackle a lot. And the idea that the Qs are a pure tech play is almost like a widely believed myth.
So a lot of my role is about dispelling those myths or trying to maybe gravitate people to what maybe more truth is than what they think. And the idea that 60% of QQQ isn't technology, I think, is quite a surprise to some people. Now, some of that is due to the GICS classification change, but that's still only a part of the story. There's consumer discretionary, consumer staples, healthcare. So there's a lot of things besides technology in there. And I just, going through the sector allocation over time, now, in the height of the tech bubble, there was a greater allocation of technology. Call it, you know, close to pushing almost 80%, not quite. And again, today, we're closer to just above 40% technology. It's definitely changed over time, but it's not 100% technology.
And I asked John, here are the Qs, one of the largest ETFs, a presumably passive trading vehicle. Even though it's been the go-to strategy for technology investing, and still is today, the makeup of the fund has changed so much over time. Can we really say that QQQ is truly passive?
The debate 10 years ago was active or passive, and I think today it's much more complicated than that, because as a fund that uses market capitalization as one of its primary determinants of what the weight is in the portfolio, in reality, it could be quite active compared to the market portfolio. So someone might consider an all-world equity portfolio or the S&P 500 to be the market. QQQ as a quote-unquote passive product is actually quite different than the market portfolio. And I think that has to do with what's not in the portfolio is what's in the portfolio. So you see overweight certain names that the portfolio holds, but it also doesn't hold certain sectors. There's no financials. There's not a lot of energy, not a lot of utilities. So at the end of the day, you have a portfolio that can behave quite differently than the standard equity markets, and it's still passive in how it's managed, but in reality, the exposures you're getting are anything but passive.
Another myth that John has to dispel surrounding the Qs is whether or not the market is ramping up to hit a tech bubble 2.0, especially as the likes of Apple, Microsoft, and Google have seen prices skyrocket. And to John, the concerns make sense. But he thinks it helps to look at QQQ today and compare it to the fund back then. So he compares today's market to the actual tech bubble. Let's call it March 2000.
The valuations are completely different. And one of the things we looked at was just look at the five largest companies in QQQ at that time compared to the five largest companies today. So one of the things we did was, instead of getting PE ratio for the whole fund, if we just did, looked at those five largest companies in the height of the tech bubble, so call it Microsoft, Cisco, Intel, Oracle, IBM, as a group, they actually traded at about close to 80 times their market cap over net income, a proxy for a PE ratio. Where today, we look at Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, Microsoft, and Facebook, and go back to the end of September, which was really the height of this year, and that group was trading at 38.5 times. So those stocks could have gone up 100% in one day and still would have been trading cheaper from a perspective of market cap to net income than the tech bubble. So it's not to say that they're screaming value, but they're not anywhere near the tech bubble. So the idea that we're anywhere near the tech bubble hysteria or heights is far off. We could get there, but we would need a couple 100% days or weeks to get to that type of level.
But for some investors, the recent run-up in technology stocks does bring about deja vu, even if the bubble hasn't quite reached its popping point. Someone you heard from earlier, NASDAQ founder John Jacobs, says he knows what to look out for. He recalls one morning when his mother called him about a trade she wanted to execute on the fund her son Johnny started.
Look, my mom in her 70s became a day trader in the queues. So I'm sitting in my office in D.C. and my phone lights up and I had this new feature, caller ID. Again, it's out a long time ago, 2000. And it was my parents' home number. And it was my mom. And I said, Mom, I was just getting ready to call you. You know, she's a 72-year-old, one brokerage account. I said, Mom, I was just getting ready to call you about something. And she goes, never mind that now, Johnny. I want to let you know what I did this morning. I called up Schwab and I put a pre-market open limit order in on the queues because I think it's going to pop at the open. I want to flip it. I'm like, oh my God, I should have known it was the boom. I should have known it was the bus right then. So here my mom is 72 years old. She become a day trader on margin, the pre-market in the queues because it's going to pop and she wants to flip it. Again, this is like the same thing. When the shoeshine boy's giving you stock tips or, you know, the kid in the corner is telling you about cryptocurrencies, I can recognize a bubble.
Carolina, happy birthday, Q's. Welcome back to the show.
I guess thank you.
First of all, I just got to say, I love the background on the letter Q. I didn't know all that. What is it, the monkey dangling from a tree?
Monkey with its tail hanging down.
Yeah, it's amazing.
But here's something I wanted to know, which is, why does it have three Q's?
So originally, actually, John Jacobs, who you heard from at the beginning and at the end of the podcast, he wanted a single character ticker. He just wanted it to be Q. There was this sort of unspoken rule that they couldn't do that. So he was like, you know what? He even printed out like 50 prospectuses with just Q and then 50 prospectuses with QQQ. And they ended up going with the triple Qs. But then it actually went to four Qs at one point. So it was QQQQ. Then it went back to three Qs. And it's funny, people say that you can tell when they invested in the Qs depending on how they refer to it. So if they refer to it as the cubes or the quad Qs, that's because it was when it was the four-letter ticker. A lot of people just call it the Qs or QQQ.
Yeah, if you see some of these old heads at the ETF conferences, they will drop a cubes. Diamonds, cubes, vipers. It's evolved a lot since then, but that's how you kind of know. And they may also put a the before a ticker, like the EEM. That's sort of how you know the sort of old school folks that maybe were in the industry in the 90s.
Before we started recording, we were joking around about personifying some ETFs. And for me, a challenge with this podcast and with this project was like, okay, I'm going to take this fund that's a mammoth in the industry. Everyone knows about it.
How big is it?
$66 billion in AUM, about second most traded. So that's
after
SPY. Yeah. So everyone knows about it. How am I going to surprise people about this? Like, how am I going to go out and report on this and find things that people don't know?
But you did, which was the surprise is that it doesn't have as much tech as people think.
Exactly. Yeah, that was a huge surprise. And the way to go about it was that I had to treat it like a person. I was like, I'm going to go out and like just report of this like biographical feature on this.
Wait,
fund.
So
hold on. So personifying ETFs is when you cross the line into where I live, which is
a scary
intelligence
place.
Line.
Scary,
yeah,
place.
You don't want to start looking at them as people. I just giving you a fair warning.
Sort
there.
Of a more like a ghost, I would say, which is even creepier, probably. But
okay, so if it's not in tech, what is it in now?
Basically, so you have to remember the NASDAQ 100 is just tracking the 100 largest non-financial companies. So that's and that's really the only thing that's been completely consistent with the fund since the beginning of time. It's just not tracking any financials. But yeah, it was about 80% at the height of the tech bubble. It's now around 40%.
Yeah, that was dropped in there, right? The GICS. What is that?
The GICS reclassification was something that happened that basically reclassified some of the just traditionally known tech names as being in the communication services sector.
Like Facebook.
Exactly. Right? Like some of those mammoths. But still, I mean, the Qs really are a poster child for tech investing. They still are.
Yeah. And when I was in data, we grappled with whether to call the Qs a sector tech or not. That's a big difference because then you look at tech flows. If the Qs are in there or not, it changes the whole number by a lot. And ultimately, we do have them in tech for now because we do feel like, what are people using them for? And I think most people still connotatively are using them for tech, but you could debate this for a while because right now I think it's 42% tech. So it's shockingly low tech to be in the tech sector. Some of these decisions are tough when you're making the taxonomy in data.
And so who's been kind of noticed that as an opportunity? Because if it's like a tech fund that everyone associates with a tech fund that doesn't have that much tech in it, that seems like a market opportunity for somebody else to come along and say, hey, I'm actually tech.
And there are a lot of funds that have just pure tech exposure to them. But you have to remember sort of the liquidity that comes with the Qs, the branding power that it has, the familiarity that people have. But again, like the largest, it's still pretty FANG heavy and FANG driven. So people will turn to it for exposure to those names.
And we had Dan Draper on ETF IQ, which is on every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Just
modest
shameless plug.
Modest plug.
And this is last week, actually. And we asked him about the Qs. You were on with him, actually. And what he said, something very interesting, because he was trying to sort of give another reason why you'd use this fund besides just quick tech exposure. And he said that there's a lot of growth in this index and that the R&D as a whole spent on the companies in the Qs was double that of the companies in the S&P 500. That's a powerful statement, and I think that leads to the growthy aspect of the Qs,
innovation,
not just
right?
tech. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. That's also something that John Frank, who is the current strategist of the Qs, which also when I went to interview him, I was like, how easy is this man's job? Like this dude sits there and he manages the Qs, which is the super well-oiled, like huge self like running machine, but actually he gets a ton of questions. It's like it's a lot of work. I mean the research that this guy knows about this fund is incredible. R&D is something he totally talked about. He said one of the things he does is he compares the NASDAQ 100 to other indexes. He'll look at the NASDAQ 100's higher R&D spend relative. So if we look at 2017 R&D spending as a percentage of sales for these companies, you're right, Eric, 9% of sales went to R&D for the NASDAQ 100 constituents. That's more than twice of that for any other comparable index.
And that's a big deal in this because everybody is talking about there's some controversy over buybacks and some people are looking for companies that do more, you know, spending on R&D and that kind of thing and not just buying back shares. So that's a pretty good selling point, especially for those who are a little not uneasy about buybacks being the source of return.
That's actually really interesting.
And, you know, when a product is a smash hit, just like the movie business, it spawns sequels and copycats, right? So their Qs, I'll think of as QQQE, which is the equal weighted Qs because the Qs does have a lot of allocation to a couple companies. I think Apple might be like 17%.
Right, market cap, as we discussed.
Yeah.
Right?
So there's equal weighted Qs. What are some other examples where they try to steal some of the Qs, audience with dropping a Q in the ticker to make people think, oh, this is like kind of a tech QE play on this other area?
So EMQQ is one that's emerging markets tech. There's TQQQ, I believe, which is a leveraged version of the Q. So they do sort of try and piggyback off of this brand.
Because it's such a monster, it's sort of like, what other shticks can we come up with here?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like the comic book Avengers, you know, all these spinoffs. And so just taking a bigger step back, you traveled out to Chicago, right, or in the suburbs of Chicago. Just talk about being out there at an ETF issuer, what does an ETF issuer's office look like and what's going on over there?
So it's massive. It's in Downers Grove, Illinois, which is a little ways way outside of downtown Chicago, but it's a huge, huge office. Orange is everywhere. You can see it in Dan Draper's office. He has even just like the front of a NASCAR car hood that's orange, and I think it has the Qs on it because the Qs sponsored a NASCAR race for a while. But when you go and you do a profile either on a person or on a fund like this, you have to find like its footprints everywhere, right? And so it is sort of scattered throughout, and I had to sort of track it and follow it throughout Chicago. So I also went to the zoo, as you know, and you heard, I spent a lot of time there trying to capture lion sounds and lion roars, because they also have some sort of marketing partnerships with the zoo there. But it has made its way into all these different little aspects of the community and sort of social life in Chicago.
And I think they also do a tennis tournament, because one time we did an event with PowerShares where Bloomberg presented PowerShares. And at the end of the event, they gave away a tennis racket signed by, I think, Jim Courier. Remember him? I think he won 2 majors. That's to make sure you stay to the end of the event.
Right, of course.
I thought that was pretty high end. I was really excited. I was not allowed to enter it because I was a presenter.
Tennis.
A bummer.
Yeah, tennis, golf. Let's wait for the Super Bowl partnership.
By the way, this has nothing to do with ETFs, but you got a lion to roar.
Yeah, I mean, how'd you do that?
I've been to the zoo many times. Those lions just lay there, usually far off behind a log, and you can't see them.
And the kid's like, lion, 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 lion. And it's like, dude, this sucks.
It's kind of underwhelming. And you saw them roar? How'd that work out?
I just yelled out, cues! No, I spent a lot of time at the zoo that day. Actually, I have to say it's an
incredible
zoo.
You just sat there.
Zoo.
Patience is the key.
I can't believe that it's free. You just really, there are people that jog through there. You walk through there. It's absolutely beautiful. And the lions, they put on a nice performance for me. They really did.
Speaking of performances, how's it done since inception?
So it came out March 1999.
That's interesting.
Yeah, right before the bubble burst. So this is including that. It's up 336% since inception. At the S&P 500, since that same exact point, is only up 226%. So it's got
outperformance
by about 109% since then. But here's what's wild. Since the financial crisis, so we'll start at the beginning of 2009, the Qs has literally doubled the S&P. It's up 600% versus 300% for the S&P. That's big time, especially for a diversified sort of larger index.
But it also speaks to what tech has done in that same period. It's just crushed it.
Absolutely. This is part of the reason it's so beloved. People made a lot of money on it.
Carolina, thanks again for joining us on Trillion.
On behalf of me and the Qs, you're welcome. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you'd like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. And you can find Carolina Wilson at Carol E. Wilson. Trillions is produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.